And welcome to another episode of the Australian Baby Boomer podcast. Today's guest is Bea, a storyteller in the raconteur style. For many years, as a member of a storytelling guild, Bea travelled around Australia and overseas as a professional storyteller, telling stories to children and adults. Bea begins with a traditional tale before we explore her own story in this fascinating profession.
Once upon a time, as all good stories begin, there were two knights who set off on a quest to find the Holy Grail. Their journey took them all over the country, and one night, on a deep, deep, stormy night, they were looking for somewhere to stay the night. It seemed there was nothing there at all, but in the distance they saw this old castle. Didn't seem to be anyone there, but suddenly they saw this tiny light, so they thought they'd make their way over and ask if they'd stay there. Well, they knocked and they knocked, and they were just about to turn away when the door opened, and a very old man came to the door. He was so happy to see them. He invited them in, he wined them and he dined them, and they gave them a bed for the night. Then around midnight, both were woken by the most horrendous sounds, the clanking of chains and the shrieking and the yelling. It sent shivers down their spine. Neither of them slept that night, and the next morning they said to the old man, "Whatever was that?" And he said, "Well, that's the secret of the castle. I was told never to tell another living soul, and I never have. But I'm getting very old now, and I need to pass it on. So if you are passing this way in a year's time and I'm still alive, I will pass on the secret of the castle to you." Well, the year went by. One of the knights was killed in a battle. It was just up to the other one. He found himself a year later right outside that very castle and wondered if the old man was still there. He was. He invited him in. He wined him and he dined him and gave him a bed for the night, and the same thing happened at midnight. The clanking of chains and the shrieking and the yelling that sent shivers down his spine. And the next morning he reminded the old man what he'd said. And the old man said, "Yes, I will pass it on. I will tell you the secret of the castle, but you must promise me you'll never ever tell another living soul." And he never did. I'm Bea, and I'm an oral storyteller. I've belonged to the Storytelling Guild for many, many years, practicing and passing on the art of the oral storyteller.
That's great, Bea. I really appreciate you starting with that story. What do you think it is about oral storytelling that's different from just reading a story or something like that?
Well, in my opinion, this is my opinion only, you get the attention of children, adults, whoever you're speaking to. They have to listen, and that's the most important piece, because they're looking at a person telling them a story, and because there isn't a book there, they have to use their imagination.
Right, and there must be things that are passed on through the voice and through the presence of a person.
Well, first and foremost, it is the imagination. Mm-hmm. But you're hearing language as well. You're hearing someone else speaking that language. And you pick up little things like idioms and just natural things that come out in the spoken word rather than actually reading it and pronouncing it in your own way.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to a storyteller lets the imagination fly. It opens windows to all sorts of things.
Yeah.
It is a dying art, yeah, which made a comeback a few years ago, but now with all the electrical gadgets and things, perhaps people don't appreciate that. So to have an oral storyteller is a novelty now.
Mm. So how did you get your platform to be able to tell stories? How did that come about?
Well, I've always loved stories. I am a great reader, an avid reader. But my father told stories when we were children. Mm. And I remembered that. And I went to a little two-roomed school, and we had a story every afternoon before we went home. And those stories remained and actually lay dormant for a long, long time until I did a degree in librarianship when I was older. And one of the units offered was storytelling, so I thought I would give it a go. And a wonderful tutor, and she said to me, "You're a natural." Mm. And I went away and thought, you know, those little ideas that come straight into your head, and I thought to myself, yes, this might, because I'm very shy and reserved, and it was just something that I found that I loved, actually.
Loved doing it. Mm. So can you tell us a bit more about that unit? What was it? Was it people actually telling
it was,
stories?
It was actually called Storytelling to Children, mm, it was called. Yes, and it just taught you to how to tell as opposed to read.
Okay.
And it gave me the confidence that I'd been lacking for quite a few years, actually. And also it gives you, to me, it was like being another persona. I would go out and I would perform. And the appreciation that you get, I often used to say, because I tell to all ages, mm, 3 to 103, but I used to say to teachers, if you sat at the front here, as I do, and see the expressions on the children's faces as they sort of either grasp it or whatever, it's just a sheer delight.
Mm. Yes, because their imaginations are very vivid, aren't they, when they're young? But people never seem to lose that love of hearing a story, do they, well told?
No, that's true. And I have told, as I say, to so many different age groups, and I was always very nervous to start with adults, actually, because I thought they might judge me. But I used to go to one of the libraries, the local libraries, and practice on the little four-year-olds that used to come on Fridays. And I thought, well, children of that age love you no matter what. Mm. But that gave me a confidence to sort of go up the scale. And I found that adults appreciate a story just as much, because a lot of them went through a time when nobody did tell stories. It was just everything had to be realism sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it was just a sheer delight. And when you're actually telling a story, adults and children, when you get to a certain point in the story and then you see their faces, they know, oh, and it's just a sheer delight.
It's,
you know,
like an aha moment, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
That's really interesting what you were saying about adults. Sometimes they're getting a second bite of the cherry in a way.
And it was interesting when I went to schools, particularly Children's Book Week, when I would notice that particularly the young teachers were listening as earnestly as the kids were, and they'd gone through that time when they didn't hear stories. And it's just, as I say, it's just a joy. And I would say more of a raconteur type of storyteller, where I sit in a chair and just use my voice and my body. Mm. Of course, storytellers come in all sorts of shapes and sizes, but it took me a few years to realise that that was my style.
Mm.
You listen to other storytellers who are more robust about it and throw their arms, more dramatic and things, and you think, so perhaps I should be doing that. But there comes a time when you realise that you have your own style. And so long as you stick to that style, then you know that, that you're more comfortable with your own style. Yes.
The other thing that occurs to me about the raconteur style, it is one that draws the person in to you to really listen deeply and hard. And I can imagine that that kind of oral storytelling is a way for children to develop a vocabulary and an ability to think between the lines. So that must help with reading as well, when they actually come to reading a book, to be able to look deeply into the subtext of the book instead of just reading what's there on the page.
Yes, yeah, well, hopefully that's what happens. But it's just the, particularly with smaller children, it's a rapt look on their face where they're really with you and they are following that tale. I've been to places where I was telling one story about Mr. Fox, who puts things into his bag and takes them away. And this little boy and his brother, I think, had been in both sessions, actually. When I got to the end of it, he turned to his brother and he said, "And I know the very dog. It's Mr. So-and-so who lives down the street." There was a little flashlight, you know, bulb moments, you know, where you think, oh, that is just absolutely delightful. And going to when the Women's Electoral Lobby was first starting, you know, and I was doing an outdoor session and completely overdressed because I wasn't dressed in white and purple and green and feeling dreadful, and looking out at this audience of all these women. And then I started my story, and when I got to a crucial part, I noticed them all nodding to one another and saying, and it was just, oh, that was just so wonderful. Because being, as any actor will tell you as well, you know that when you have your audience with you, and it's that moment when you feel it's all being worthwhile.
And it's the relationship. There's something about being there in the moment, and there's something risky about that as well, isn't there, with the, that you're telling a story without the kind of safety net of a written piece of work in front of you.
But that's really much easier in one way, because certain storytellers learn in certain ways. With me, I remember different little pieces. It's like I also have a picture in my mind, and that happens then and that happens then. And when you're storytelling, it doesn't matter if you miss a word out or anything like that, because nobody knows any different. And you can also, like one of my giant stories where I forgot the most crucial thing, so halfway through the story I say things like, "Oh, by the way, did I tell you about such and such?" You see, you can get away with that when you when you're telling. I actually do stick to the old traditional stories. I love the old folk tales, myths and legends, the Greek ones in particular, because they're good stories. They've got the basis of, they've got a beginning, a middle and an end. And you don't necessarily have to tell them verbatim, but you can make them and turn them into your story and use the structure to make your own structure around it. And I do lean on those kinds of stories particularly. I will tell personal stories to adults sometimes, but I also take one of the old tales and make it more personal. You can do that. You can be very adaptable. And I don't need to strut across a stage or throw my arms at, well, I do talk with my hands, but I don't need to do that, you know, my way of storytelling. Everyone is different.
And I believe you went to, through the storytelling career, you actually went to another country or other...
I've been to Asia, right. Yes. I've been to Singapore in particular quite a few times. I also lecture and I do workshops as well, not just a simple story. And I've been all over Australia, and I've told in England as well when I've been over there. Yes.
Wow. So so what sort of stories did you tell in, say, Singapore? I guess it's a different cultural environment.
It is, but I... you have to be very careful that you're not offending anybody. So I usually start off by saying, this is my culture. And then I can tell from my culture, because you have to remember the mores of all these countries as well, though, because For instance, a dragon tale. The dragons are revered in Asia, and language that you can use, or sort of, you don't want to have to make explanations. So if you tell them right at the very beginning, one of my things that I did, which I can't do now, is particularly with older children, is I would start a story and get them to tell me things in this story, and then at the end of it, I would. Because I would have remembered, I would tell their story. And it was so strange when you go to Blobby Tell a Dragon, and you have to remember that in certain countries they don't have roofs, they live in flats, and all those sorts of little things that happen in different places. As I say, when you go up north, I always explain myself and say that because, particularly on the School of the Air, they will say, "Where do you come from, miss?" And I'll say, "And no, where do you come from?" Because they can only hear the voice,
right?
You see. So I do go to the trouble of explaining, having a little talk so that they've got my voice before I start, because sometimes you're going to think, "Where does she come from?" And this happens with all sorts of stories.
So you would have to be quite adaptable and good at improvising. And you don't also have to be a very good listener as a storyteller.
That is something that you do, and particularly when I do workshops, and then you listen to other people's stories as well. You do have to be a good listener. You do have to have both, actually.
Yeah.
And also you have to be aware of the surroundings, all sorts of things that you have to take into consideration. Oh, that was the other thing. And when you go to Asia, you have to learn to speak. I've always been told that I'm clear. Mm. They can tell what I say. But you have to slow down, because when English isn't their first language, you have to be very careful. There are lots of things that you do have to remember. These are things that you learn, though, as you go along, and then you remember the next time. I always have, because I'm a librarian, I always have a list of stories. And I have lists for different ages, and I have lists for adults. Mm-hmm. And then I assess my audience. And I have no qualms about, I say, this story isn't working. I know, we weren't going to tell that one now. We'll tell something else, because I can see from the audience. Because I never know what the audiences are. Mm. I mean, one group is ready for anything. I remember going to a high school, and there were 15-year-olds, and they came strolling in, as boys do, and this one sat right in front of me and put his legs were longer than me, and he sat there and he sat back, more or less say, "Okay, amuse me." And I told it was a Scottish tale, actually, about a kelpie. A kelpie there is someone who lives in the river, a river nymph. And at the end of it, he'd listened. I'd watched him intently, listened to it all. "Well, excuse me, miss," he said, "did that kelpie actually die or what?" And I nearly laughed out loud, because I thought, "You've been listening all the way through. You know, I got you."
Yes.
You know, those sorts of things are little gems, you know.
It's a little bit like Scheherazade, isn't it?
Yes,
you know?
It is like Scheherazade. Yes, I always say it weaves you and draws you in, you know. And, I can honestly say that I come alive. This is a different me who goes out there. There's one funny little episode then when I was overseas. My daughter was with me, and I remember what I was wearing. I had a blue T-shirt with storytelling across here and a white skirt lined, and I'm just going out on the stage, and my daughter said to me, "Have you got flowers on your knickers, Mum?"
You can see through.
Oh dear. I thought I'm going to sit down on this stage. Funny little episodes that come back to, you know, it didn't stop me performing.
No.
Yeah.
So the ability to switch quickly, if you picked up that a story wasn't working, to switch to something else or to change the story around to make it.
Well, I'd say that comes with experience.
Right.
You know, the many years that I've done it, you know, when I wasn't feeling nervous anymore, and suddenly you'd see a restlessness there, and I think, no. And then I wouldn't feel happy, and so I'd just say, as I say, I don't think I'm going to tell this one. But the other thing as well is I've done Children's Book Week for years, went to the same library for years, my local library for years as well, and I like year twos for some unknown reason. I love their logic, and people say they haven't got logic. And I said, yes, they have. But this particular one, I thought, oh, school's coming again. Oh, they're year twos now, so I'll tell the year two. And halfway through, one little boy put his hand up and he said, excuse me, miss. He said, could you tell us the one about the giant and the chicken? And all the kids are going, oh, yes, yes, yes. And I thought, how delightful. They've remembered me from last year. So I had to churn up my memory and tell them that tale again. Isn't oh, such delight.
They're gorgeous, aren't they? Mm. Do you think, I think often kids seem to love having stories repeated too. There's something about a familiar story and the kind of, you know, just almost anticipating the ending and then getting pleasure from when the ending comes up.
I think it's like, well, when I used to go down to the school, when I was practising at the little library that I used to go to, there was one little girl there who insisted to the mother, there's a book about a cow on a roof and it's in set in Holland somewhere. I'm borrowing that book every week. Mm-hmm. They got it back every week. And I think it's the same with stories, you know, that they remember. Something resonates. Can I tell you about when I was at one of the country schools up north? I did the whole school, starting with the babies right up to year seven. And the year twos were a delight because I loved them. And there was one little Aboriginal boy, and he was sitting there and he was listening because I think they used to stories. So off they went. Go up to here. The next morning, I did the rest of the school. And, oh, Mrs. B, before you go, the year two teacher came in and she said, we've got something to show you. And it was my chicken and giant story. Mm. And the one who was telling the rhymes and was a little Aboriginal boy. But the funniest thing about it was he got my voice.
Oh,
it was okay. My voice. And I thought that was the most delightful thing that I'd ever seen.
Yes.
And then I went and got on the plane. And it was just, oh, it's remained in my memory all those years.
Yes.
And I very often find that when kids are telling them back, they've got my voice as well.
I think stories are a wonderful way of remembering things as well. So you tend to remember the details of a story because you do listen very carefully if it's a well-told story.
Well, yes, they do. You can see that concentration of listening. I've had people who say, don't mind about so-and-so wandering, he's autistic or something like that. And I've found that by the end of the session, that child, it may not be sitting, but he's listening.
Mm.
And I think there is the power of the voice, you know, I really do. I do think that a lot of posturing and hands and things like that does detract from the story and becomes a distraction. But that's only me saying because I don't do it. I find that adults listen and are a wonderful audience. And I had one particular time, which was only brought up the other day, years ago, when it was a Halloween night and I told a modern version of Tam Lin, a Scottish tale, and it was dark in the room, atmospheric, and I sat and told this tale.
Mm.
And at the end of it, complete silence, and I nearly died. I thought, oh dear, I flopped. And I started talking about something else, and afterwards one of the ladies said, don't you realise that's the highest compliment you could get?
Mm.
I said, no, I didn't actually. I thought I'd really failed there, you know, but that's a moment to remember as well. But all these things that happen, you take to your next session and remember, you remember these things. Where did I go wrong there? What worked well there? Where am I going?
Mm. There's something about the old idea of sitting around a campfire too and telling stories in the dark. It reminded me when you were talking about that one, being in the dark and telling stories to one another and just being able to conjure up.
Well, I was a girl guide and I remember many campfires of that happening. There is something magical, actually.
Mm.
And I think just the thing of actually sitting and listening, because I enjoy other storytellers as much as I enjoy telling.
Mm.
It's just a delight, actually, to listen. And the variety. There's so many varieties. So many people have their own styles. I love listening to a story, but I'm sure that reflects back to my dad. and also from the school, from sort of primary school.
It feels universal though, because it just, it'd be hard pressed to find a people or a culture in the world where storytelling wasn't quite a central part of life. Really,
well, it's strange to be. I love Ireland. Ireland is a second home to me. I tell lots of Irish tales, and that of course has been around for a long time. But it's very interesting when you sort of might be searching for a story, and I'll look at 100 or more, that you see the universal story, particularly of how the world began and all the different creatures, the birds, how they were created. We're here in the Aboriginal, got them in the Indian. You get them all over the world, these stories that are the same story. And, of course, stories really with the trade routes and the Silk Road and those sorts of things. This is how, as people began to move around, these stories spread. So you can hear them in the European ones, the Grimm tales and those sorts of things, but you'll hear those same stories from another culture. Mm. It's just so interesting.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
I don't tell Aboriginal stories, and I don't tell many Australian tales, because to me, you need an Australian accent.
I think you're right in telling stories from your own cultural background, and there's an authenticity to that, and there are a lot of good Aboriginal storytellers, and it's lovely to hear the stories from all the different parts of the world. And
well, I have been to many conferences. Each state has had a conference. We've had two here in Perth, and there's usually an Aboriginal teller or two. There are people from all over the world who come to them, and telling their own stories, you know. And yes, it's lovely to hear from different cultures, Japanese, and they all got their own stories. I tell the folk tales from Europe mainly, and England, but it was really, I think, at the end of the 19th century that the English ones started to be written down. Yeah. Most of them came from Europe, the Grimm's tales and those sorts of things. But there've always been different tales around.
Do you think with children telling stories that... Because I'm thinking about the Grimm's fairy tales and how grim they were, really. And I seem to remember reading them as a child and being quite drawn in, but... Do you think children can handle the darkness in stories?
Yes. I don't particularly like the Grimm's tales. There are some that I will tell. But I'll seek out other gentler ones, because they can be very, very gruesome. But, you see, they went around people's houses collecting those tales, and they were true to life. Mm. That's how people lived. And that's how people acted. I remember going to Ireland after my husband died. I went on a tour this time. And we went to where the National Theatre is. And we were a little bit late because the driver got lost. And we went in and the play was starting. And to our astonishment, it was in Gaelic. And we watched them perform. And you knew immediately what... You didn't need the language. Mm. You just knew what they were saying. And I think this happens. I've been in Paris when they've been street artists, and I don't speak fluent French, but because of the way they were speaking, their actions, you knew exactly what they were saying. So storytelling is universal.
Mm. It's really wonderful. And I guess it's a way we understand our worlds. And not only that, there are a lot of lessons embedded in stories, aren't there?
Yes, sort of the truths, really, that come out. And
emotional truths as well.
Emotional truths, and I think this is why Carl Jung explored the old folk tales, you know, because there were so many deep inner feelings and inner emotions. And mind you can interpret any way you like, really. And that goes with telling. Mm. No storyteller tells the same story the same way, and because they have no copyright on them, those old tales, you can twist them and turn them to your how you want to interpret and say them, actually, but still keeping the same structure, because the structure's already there. Yes. You don't have to change that. But any hidden meanings, if you found them, if other people found them, and that again, people will take away a story and interpret exactly how they feel it what it means to them and how they could tell it as well. And then someone else will tell that story. And it sounds entirely different because they've put a different interpretation on it, and also the way they tell it as well.
Mm. It occurred to me that one of the things with telling a story compared to reading a story for a picture book or something like that is that each person has their own image of the hero or the heroine or the villain or the setting and all of that kind of thing. And so it's very much more individualised to what the person's imagining, isn't it?
Yes, they've no concept of colour, of space or anything that is in... Well, as you say, the characters as well, they've got to... And I will have questions asked as well afterwards as well. Do you think? And I think, no, I don't know actually, but you make up your own mind what you think. What do you think about it? I'm hoping that it does open a window into the imagination with children.
It seems to continue on too, doesn't it? So once you've finished telling the story, if people are asking questions about it, or kids in particular are happy, quite keen to ask questions about the story, it's as though it has a life of its own, which continues on past the telling, and it becomes a part of imaginative play or in the mind.
I have given workshops and things. I've given workshops to children as well, actually, and not really how to tell a story, is how to create, actually, create in your head a story to tell. And I've done quite a few workshops for adults as well who've wanted to do it. And it's interesting the type of people that you had through, because we've had psychologists, we've had vicars, we've had doctors, and really all to see how they can relate face to face. I think that is one of the things, actually, that is important, that you are facing your audience and there's just you. You can't hide behind anything, it's just you.
There's certainly a lot of communication that goes on just through being present, isn't there?
Present. The body you've got your body language, yes, and the face-to-face sort of thing.
Yeah, and you're picking up how people are responding to the story, so that you're adjusting, making little adjustments all the time according to how people are picking it up.
Yes, that is quite true. I have had audiences of 100 children, actually, and you can't do it with everybody, but you will pick out a few smiling faces I usually look for in the audience that gives you an indication of how it's going. So actually your eyes are roaming when you've got big crowds like that to see who's listening, how it's going, and picking up that. And I have had people say to me, particularly in Asia, could hear every word you said, it was so clear. And that in itself is a compliment, because you know that they are hearing
and listening.
Yes.
So how do you do you have feelings on how things are changing now for children and for this whole storytelling tradition?
Well, I think so. I haven't done it for some time now, actually, because like everything else, it's evolving, and it seems to me to be more performance-wise now, probably because you've got to get the kids away from all the handheld gadgets that they've got these days, really. They do still hold them. It's been Children's Book Week, I think it's this week, actually. They still have storytellers in libraries and things like that, so the children do get the opportunity. But I just feel that this contact, face-to-face contact, is certainly moving. I know that actually when I'm walking along a street and someone with an iPad in their hand walks into me, that it's the written word that they're looking at. They're not actually communicating with people or noticing that I was actually in front of them. That sort of thing. I do feel that it is changing. I think they're still reading books, but most of the course are on their iPads and phones and things like that. You know, they're getting them off there. They're not even picture books and things. They're all on these small screens. So, when I first came into it, which was 83... we'd come back into it. It was the Storytelling Guild was started by a group of teachers and librarians who I think were making sure that the kids got to hear stories and use imagination, because they'd gone through the 70s where everything did have to be real. You had to speak the proper way, and you weren't allowed to use your imagination. And I think that was something, you know, that they brought in, and it's been carried on since then. 78 that was, and I've been a member since 1983. I'm actually a life member. And like everything else, it's evolved.
Mm.
So yeah. Perhaps people will come back to it. I could just tell you an interesting thing about Singapore. When I was first there in the 90s, there was no storytelling on the curriculum at all. But now it's absolutely thriving.
Mm.
Absolutely thriving. They took me out for dinner when I was over there the last time. And I like to think that perhaps I had a little bit of an input there. Yes, but it was very interesting. So talking about evolving, that is one thing in particular that I have noticed. Yeah.
And it's one of those things where they say that the jobs that people will do in the future don't even exist now, and that people are going to have to be very adaptable, and that the use of imagination is going to have to be quite an important component of that. So I guess this is where you could have your swings and roundabouts of the storytelling coming back, because it does promote that, helps to develop that in children and in adults, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. I'm sure that if I was to go into a group now, I think I could attract their attention, because it would be a novelty.
Yes.
It would take them away from... And this is how again, we're talking about evolution, this is how it has evolved. Mm. It's gone through so many different stages.
Yeah.
And I think now it would be a novelty.
Mm. Thanks to Bea for sharing her own stories, knowledge and insights about storytelling. The more we talked, the more I began to realise just how important stories are to the human experience. They grow our imaginations, give us pleasure and help us to feel what it might be to stand in the shoes of another. This is hardly news to Bea, who has made storytelling and forming warm and true connections with her audiences central to her life. It is these positive experiences that children take away with them and remember all of their lives. And to use one of Bea's expressions, the exchange is delightful for teller and listener alike. And until next time, thank you for listening.